This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Can we really run civilization with just hydro, solar, and wind power? Scientist Ken Caldera says almost, but not quite, in a new study. But we have already dumped too many greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. From the UK, scientist David Beerling explains a big new solution: laying down carbon-grabbing rock as fertilizer in the world's fields. James Hansen is a co-author on that one. We wrap with environmental journalist Stephen Leahy reporting the good and bad news as cities lead the way. This is Radio EcoShock. Welcome aboard. Is the dream of a civilization powered by the wind, the sun, and water just that, a dream that cannot become a reality? Our guest, Ken Caldera, argues that solar and wind power can take us a long way, but not all the way. That scientific argument has spilled out of the journals into social media, blogs, tweets, and the law courts. Dr. Caldera is one of the most famous and respected atmospheric scientists in the world. His home base is the Carnegie Institution for Science in the Department of Global Ecology. Ken has published groundbreaking papers on ocean acidification, geoengineering, and near-zero emissions. He co-authored key papers for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. Ken Caldera, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you for that nice introduction.
Well, we're here to talk about the new paper, Geophysical Constraints on the Reliability of Solar and Wind Power in the United States. Ken, to set the big picture, do you think we are already on our way to a new climate?
Yes, we're very definitely causing the planet to get warmer and causing weather patterns to shift around the world. And for the last two decades, it's been clear that humans are the primary cause of this climate change.
And as you know too well, the MIT professor Mark Jacobson published a paper in December 2015 outlining how the United States could power up with just wind, water, and solar. 2 years later, you, along with others, including the lead author Christopher Clack, issued a very negative rebuttal paper, also in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Can you introduce us to the sides of this disagreement?
Yes. I mean, first, let's a little background. Most people doing energy modeling take the existing energy system, the electric grid and power plants and so on, as a given, and then look at, well, how could we, what would we add, or how could we shift from there? And Mark Jacobson did something very useful. He tried to present a vision of what a future near-zero emission energy system would look like. And he severely constrained the option. So he said, let's do it using only, trying to do only wind power, solar power, and hydropower dams. And he concluded, oh, that it would be possible to power all of civilization using only those energy sources. And I guess if you're talking in terms of physical possibility, could we physically do it? I think most people would concur that it's possible. But the question is it feasible in the real world, given real world constraints on how much people are willing to pay and also how much they're willing to tolerate blackouts and so on? And the main issue has to do with getting that last bit of reliability out of our electric sector, and then also about, you know, how to deal with heavy industry. So right now, most of our electricity comes from burning fossil fuels, gas and coal primarily. And most people who want to deal with the climate change problem see replacing those fossil fuel sources, gas, oil, and coal, with wind, solar, maybe electricity, or if we are to use fossil fuels, to capture the carbon dioxide and stuff it underground or someplace else. And so the real issue is that sometimes, even across the entire United States, the wind doesn't blow very much for a couple of weeks at a time. And then, as we all know, in the wintertime, there's less sunlight, and at night, there's no sunlight. And so this question of, well, how do you power modern civilization when the sun's not shining and the wind's not blowing is a major question for the reliability of the electric sector. And one of the problems is, I'm sorry for babbling on so long, that batteries are really expensive. The obvious thing would be to just charge a bunch of batteries during the day or during windy times and use them at other times. But batteries would have to get over 100 times cheaper for them really to cost effectively fill that role. And so then people have suggested, well, what about using reservoirs and so on? I don't want to get too far into the weeds here. But if you could get really cheap energy storage, then we could run our electric system off of intermittent wind and solar. But given that storing energy is really hard, and storing electricity in particular is really hard and really expensive, it's hard to see how we get much beyond, say, 80% of our electricity coming from wind and solar. And 80% is a huge fraction. And so, but that's 80% on the annual average. At some particular moments, most of our energy would need to come from some other source. So the question really boils down to the question of electricity storage. Is there a cheap way to store electricity? And that's for the electric side. On the other side, are there good ways to make steel or cement without burning fossil fuels? That's a different question.
But what about the mega storage projects being installed in Australia by Elon Musk's company? And Statoil is working on it. Maybe mass energy storage is coming.
The storage projects that are being built typically have enough electricity storage to run the countries they're in for minutes at best, and often seconds. So they're big mega storage site facilities, but when you think of how much electricity an entire country uses, it turns out it's not very much. So if you have wind power, maybe right now it's gusty, but 15 minutes later it won't be so windy, and then a half hour from then it will be windier. And these kind of battery storage are really good for smoothing out that kind of minute-to-minute gustiness of winds, and maybe a little bit of helping with the afternoon peak of demand and so on. But they're really for smoothing things out within a single day, and not so much for storing energy from one day to the next. So, one of the problems is that if you buy a battery and you're using it every single day, well, then you're getting 365 days a year use of that battery. But if you're trying to use it for seasonal storage to store, say, solar energy from the summer to the winter, then you're only using that battery once a year. And if you're using it once a year, you have to divide the cost of that battery by one, whereas if you're using it every day, you can divide the cost of that battery by 365. And so to use batteries to store beyond a day starts getting really expensive.
Now, in November of 2014, Mark Jacobson described his plan for all green power here on Radio EcoShock, but he did not talk much about his heavy reliance on a projected renaissance of hydroelectric power. You've seen problems with that.
Yes. One of the ways that Mark Jacobson in his work obtained huge amounts of very cheap storage was to assume that we could get 15 times the amount of electricity from dams in the United States that we currently get. That's an instantaneous flow rate. So, that we would be able to turn on dams and have a total dam flow. I forget exactly the number was, but it was something like 10 or 100 times the flow of the entire Mississippi River. So it was, there was some huge, basically assumed that we could get 15 times the amount of power from dams than we can actually get. And so most people who've studied our energy system thinks that expanding our dams by a factor of 15 is simply impossible.
And your new paper says the limitations of about 80% solar and wind and water are not really social or economic, but geophysical. Why geophysical?
Well, there's been a number. Economics obviously plays into it, but we did a recent paper, and we tried to sort of push economics to the background and bring the basic science of how our world functions to the foreground. And if you just look at the modulation of solar energy, it's basically the orbit of the Earth around the sun and the tilt of the Earth in its orbit, and that's modulated by clouds. But there's a certain and fairly predictable amount of sunlight reaching the surface of the Earth. Similarly, the winds and their variability are governed by basic geophysics of our planet's climate system. And there's really issues of the fundamental variability of the winds, even at broad continental scale. So one of the ways that people have suggested getting around the need for large batteries or electricity storage was to make an electric grid, maybe a high voltage direct current grid covering the entire country. And the idea being, well, maybe if it's not windy in Iowa, it'll be windy in Maine. And if you have enough places interconnected, it'll all average out. And so we said, okay, let's imagine you have a perfect electric grid covering the entire contiguous United States. Are the winds really decorrelated enough one place to another that it would all smooth everything out? And we found that that really wasn't true. Even at the scale of the entire continental United States, sometimes you get a couple of weeks where it's not very windy. And so this duration of periods without wind and without very much sun is really a product of the physics of our climate system and not any real economic assumption. So we did an analysis based on the physics of how the winds and the sun go. How much storage would you need to provide different levels of reliability? So we started just from the physics of the climate system rather than the economics of energy system.
Ken Caldera, I don't want to spend our valuable time together rehashing the lawsuit that Mark Jacobson launched against his scientific critics, but I was alarmed to see another scientist publish his energy critique anonymously in your blog to avoid legal action. Has Jacobson's suit brought a chill to scientific discussion?
Yes, just to back up a little bit, that Mark, we wrote a paper criticizing Mark's paper, suggesting that he made a modeling error in that he did not put any cap on the instantaneous amount of electricity that could be generated by dams in the United States. And so he needed an amount of electricity to be able to be generated by dams that it's comparable to our total energy use, electricity use today. And the idea that we could get all of our electricity today from running dams just is implausible. And he objected to us saying that there was a modeling error, and he claimed that that was a defamation of his character. And instead of using the normal peer review process to address scientific and technical criticism, he resorted to the courts and filed a suit against the National Academy of Sciences and our lead author, Chris Clack. And this suit cost the National Academy several hundred thousand dollars to defend against and cost Chris Clack something like $75,000 to defend against. And when it looked like the judge was going to dismiss the case and also allow what's called an anti-SLAPP case to go forward, which is, I'm going to that one later, but when it looked like the judge was going to dismiss the case, Mark withdrew his lawsuit. And there's been rumors of a number of other cases where somebody provided technical criticism of Mark Jacobson's work, and he responded by threatening to sue them in court. And anyway, it's one thing to sue the National Academy, who has substantial resources to defend, but the average working scientist does not want to get embroiled in a lawsuit. And so people have been somewhat reluctant to come out publicly and criticize Mark's work. People have come to me and said, oh, well, I'm up for a tenure decision, and I don't want to get embroiled in these kind of debates be subject to a lawsuit while I'm in a tenure decision, or just people, you know, not everybody can come up with $75,000 to defend against these things. I mean, one of the things that's, if somebody writes up their own lawsuit, the filing fees, I think, are something like $220, and that can cost many tens of thousands of dollars to defend against. And so really, I mean, the way our legal system works, it's very easy for somebody to create big problems for somebody else. just by filing a lawsuit against them, harassing them. And, you know, it might be that the National Academy or Chris Clack is able to recover their legal expenses. But right now, they're just eating that expense. And so other people don't want to have to go through that. Yeah, so somebody recently provided a critique of Mark Jacobson's treatment of hydropower in his work, and this person was afraid to be publicly associated with their work. So they gave it to me to post on my blog, you know, to get that, their work out without being personally identified with. And actually, it's interesting. I thought the person who communicated it to me was the writer. I later found out it was somebody else actually wrote it. So I, at the time I published it, I didn't even know who wrote it myself.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith. We are talking about the limits to green energy with super scientist Ken Caldera. Ken, your new paper also mentions emergency needs for power, assuming that climate change leads to more and more extreme weather events, drought that could reduce hydropower, fires that can wipe out transmission lines. How does climate change itself feed back into the demand for electricity?
That's a complicated question. And I think the first answer is that it does influence demand, but I think it's a secondary influence in that there's a lot of other technological change, and a lot of technological change goes faster than climate change. If you see over the last decades in the United States, we shifted largely from a manufacturing economy to a service economy, and these kinds of societal changes also have a big influence on demand. And then also we've seen the technologies change, the rise of fracking and natural gas. And so, you know, there's a lot of technical and societal changes that are large, and climate change is just one of many factors shaping the energy system. But one of the things that we can know for demand, that in the South, there's a substantial demand for air conditioning and electricity for cooling purposes, and it's likely that that demand will go up. But conversely, in places like Minnesota and North Dakota, the demand for heating will go down. And so the basic picture is a reduction in heating costs in the northern parts of the United States and an increase in cooling costs in the southern part. The winds are a tougher question. The general theory suggests that it should be a little bit less windy in a warmer world, but that's not a huge effect. So it might be slightly less windy, but that is not, it's not likely to be a huge effect. And so probably the bigger influence would be on heating and cooling costs. Just to say, the air conditioner is an amazing invention. You know, we wouldn't have the cities of Miami or Houston or Atlanta being the modern cities they are without the invention of air conditioning. And one of the major questions for climate change is, you know, will people in poor tropical countries get rich enough to have air conditioners? And that climate change will be a lot tougher to deal with if you're not rich enough to go indoors into an air-conditioned environment.
I think people will either go underground or be air conditioned if it gets the kind of heat that we're looking at. You've written about a near zero emissions world, yet this new paper does talk about natural gas as a possible form of dispatchable power. What is dispatchable power, and how could we consider natural gas when the sky's already overfilled with greenhouse gases?
Excellent question. So one could think of basically two types of electricity power sources. There are things like wind and solar that, you know, nature gives you whenever the wind is blowing or the sun is shining. And then there's things like natural gas, which gives you electricity whenever you turn the knob and on and have it generate. And the problem is that you have this variable generation from wind and solar, and then you also have variable demand shifting from minute to minute, from day to day. And so the question is, how do you fill that gap between the variable and intermittent wind and solar production and the variable demand? And so you need something that you can turn on and off or throttle forward and back to match that gap. And, you know, if we had enough batteries or enough hydro, that could be it. If we had natural gas, that could be it. Now, there was a study by, two studies actually, one by the branch of the Department of Energy and another by a branch of the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, and they both concluded that if we had a bunch of fossil fuel backup, mostly natural gas, that we could get around 80% of our emissions out of our electric generation system. So most of the time we'd be relying on wind and solar, but when that wasn't, wind wasn't blowing, sun wasn't shining, we would run natural gas in the background. Now, the problem with that, of course, is that natural gas is itself a potent greenhouse gas, and when you burn it, you make carbon dioxide, and that's a greenhouse gas, and you'd like to get that out of the system. So how do you do that? And this is a central challenge, and I don't think anybody has the best answer. It is possible to capture the carbon dioxide from a natural gas plant and stuff that carbon dioxide underground. It's thought that that would more or less double the cost of electricity from natural gas. It's also been suggested that nuclear power could fill that role, but obviously nuclear power is controversial. Maybe batteries could get cheaper, but they'd really have to get like 100 times cheaper for them really to fill that role in an economically sensible way. And so this, so it seems like there's plenty we can do today to get most of the way to the goal of getting carbon dioxide emissions out of our energy system. But that last 20% is still a challenge, and maybe technological innovation would help, or maybe we'll just decide to spend a bunch of money at some point. But right now, it's a pretty daunting technical challenge.
An obvious question likely coming from our listeners, why don't we just reduce our power needs to the 80% capacity that solar, wind, and water can provide?
Yeah, well, that 80% is 80% on a national average over the entire year. But there are certain times when, you know, we might only get one quarter of our power, say, from wind and solar. And, you know, for our national economy to have three quarters of the country in a blackout situation would really have fairly devastating economic consequences. And so that's why it's important in these discussions to think about what's physically possible and what's feasible. And so it's physically possible to shut down three quarters of our economy when the wind's not blowing, but it's probably not politically feasible to do such a thing. That said, I think a lot can be done, maybe not as much as we need, but you know, things like automating our dishwashers so they run in the middle of the night when electricity demand is low and they turn off in the afternoon, or maybe the refrigerator would cool itself a little bit more in the morning, and then it wouldn't turn on in the afternoon when there's peak power. And so I think, or charging electric cars could be shifted to off-peak hours. And so I think there's a lot that can be done with demand management, and that will help a lot. And it is something that we need to be working on, but it's not going to be enough to do the whole thing on its own.
We just have time for two quick questions. Your paper's about how much of the grid can be supplied by solar, wind, and water in the United States. A new study just came out evaluating the same question in the UK. What did they find?
They found a result very similar to our own, that you can get a substantial amount of emissions reduction through introduction of these intermittent renewables like wind and solar, but that it gets very expensive to get the last bits that way. I mean, the main problem is, you know, let's say you've already gotten enough wind and solar to satisfy 99% of our electrical demand. And now you need to add a whole bunch more for that 1% of the time when the wind's not blowing. But all that stuff that you add, you're only using it 1% of the time. And so if you're buying something and you're using it all the time, well, then you can distribute that cost over all the time you're using it. But if you're buying something and you're only using it 1% of the time, it becomes really expensive for that 1% of the time. So you'd really like something that's pretty cheap that you could turn on for those moments. But also, if you can shift that load so you don't need the power that 1% of the time, that would be great.
Are you optimistic we will find a way out in time before rapid climate change overwhelms us?
I'm optimistic when it comes to technology and what we're able to do. But I have to say that given the current state of Congress and the executive branch, that we will get politicians that will make good decisions, I'm increasingly skeptical. So I think from a pure, I don't think it's that big a deal that, you know, economists estimate it would cost us something like 2 or 3% of GDP to solve the climate problem. Right now we're spending, I think, something like close to 8 or 9% on the military budget. We're spending, I think, 18% on healthcare budget. And if we would just make the healthcare budget, say, 20% more efficient, which would still make us have more expensive healthcare than everybody else in the world, that would free up enough resources to solve the climate problem. So I think we could do it. And the problem is really the dysfunction in Washington that is causing our country to fail to address the most pressing problems facing this country today.
The paper, Geophysical Constraints on the Reliability of Solar and Wind Power in the United States, was just published in the journal Energy and Environmental Science. The lead author is Matthew R. Shaner. Our guest and co-author is Dr. Ken Caldera from the Department of Global Ecology at the Carnegie Institution for Science. To hear all sides and dig deeper, find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Ken, thank you so much for taking your incredibly busy time to talk to us about science.
Well, thank you very much for such a well-informed interview. I think this is the most well-informed interview I've done so far on this topic.
Thank you again. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Currently, we are headed for horrible climate change, or maybe climate catastrophe. Decades ago, we could have saved ourselves by stopping the use of fossil fuels. Now, even rapid decarbonization is not enough. Somehow, we have to recapture our previous emissions and store them safely away from the atmosphere. Some drastic geoengineering plans have been suggested, including darkening the sun with more pollution. A new paper investigates a less harmful way to capture carbon and help crop production at the same time. It has the blessing of James Hansen. From the University of Sheffield, UK, we have reached the lead author, Dr. David J. Beerling. He is a professor of natural sciences and director of the Leverhulme Center for Climate Change Mitigation. Beerling is the author of 200 papers and the best-selling book, The Emerald Planet, How Planets Changed Earth's History. We'll be talking about a big new paper titled Farming with Crops and Rocks to Address Global Climate, Food, and Soil Security. David Beerling, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex.
What in your previous science life led you to investigate an agricultural solution for climate change?
That's an interesting question. I think every academic has their own career trajectory or goes on their own research journey. The first part of my research was really investigating how the evolution of terrestrial ecosystems affected atmospheric CO2 levels. So all the way back to the Paleozoic, so 400 million years ago, when we had tiny plants, through to the arrival of the great swamp forest in the Carboniferous. 300 million years ago, there was a 100 million year transition, and the CO2 at that time, we think, plummeted by about 90%. And there was a hypothesis that it was driven by the rise of deep-rooting trees and forests across the landscape. And so I spent quite a lot of time in my first part of my career investigating both the sort of theoretical aspects of that hypothesis, but also doing experiments. And then it became very apparent that I could translate this knowledge into trying to think about how we could accelerate weathering using crop plants as a way of capturing CO2.
Where did the idea of enhanced weathering to capture CO2, where did that come from?
So the idea of adding crushed rocks and minerals to soils has been around since about the 1980s. I think it was one of the first proponents was Olaf Schuling in the Netherlands. And I think, you know, the idea sort of kicked around, but nobody had really sort of picked it up and run with it. And particularly, nobody had thought about doing it with cropland systems, agricultural systems. There were one or two reports in the literature, but I think our paper was the first to really pull all the different lines of evidence together and marshal the concept in a sort of coherent way and say, look, this could be done, and it's a very interesting way forward.
Well, as you say, rock weathering has modified climates in past ages. How does the speed of those natural processes compare to what we need now?
So the natural processes are really small. So today, the natural processes of rock weathering that are going on, they capture about 0.2, a fifth of a billion tons of carbon dioxide a year. And what we would be hoping to do would be to accelerate the process to the point where we're capturing maybe two or three gigatons or billion tons a year. So that's quite a significant increase.
It's my understanding, David, there are two types of CO2 capture with carbon-grabbing rock, and one is in the ocean and the second on land. Is that correct?
That's correct. So there are hypotheses that suggest if you put silicate rocks in the oceans, then they would weather and capture carbon. But, I mean, the issue for me with that is that you're sort of cutting out the middleman, which would be the croplands. And if there are these well-defined benefits that we explain in the paper, then why not have those benefits for crops to enhance food and soil security and capture carbon rather than just chuck all this material in the oceans? And I think, you know, that does raise a second point, which is very important and very topical at the moment, is that people are very sensitive, and the public is very sensitive, and rightly so, about us chucking billions of tons of rock into the oceans. And I think we've seen most recently about, you know, the problem with plastics and plastic pollution in the oceans, how the public responds so quickly and with alarm to that sort of situation. So I could see there being potential problems with introducing large amounts of rock directly into the oceans.
David, has anyone actually tested the cropland method you propose on land?
Yes, well, currently we are undertaking some large-scale trials with 4-hectare plots that are being dosed with crushed basalt. And the plots are fully environmentally audited, and we're able to determine, or will be able to determine, not only the extent to which carbon capture is happening, but also the feedback on crop production and yields.
Well, let's try to dig a little deeper into this paper without drowning, because it's huge. There are just so many subjects encapsulated in it. But the crops, how do they play into this scheme for carbon capture?
So they play into it because the crops maintain root systems, and those root systems form symbiotic associations with fungi called mycorrhiza. And we know that when you add crushed rocks and minerals to soils, then the mycorrhizal fungi and the roots preferentially target those rocks to break them down to extract the trace nutrients that are present in there. So the crops and the rooting systems and the microbes directly play a role in accelerating the breakdown of the rock grains.
So I'm part of a gardening crew who have been putting rock dust on the gardens to get better plants. Now I'm thrilled to learn that I might eventually help a little bit with climate change.
Sure, and you know, there are reports in the literature that if you grow pumpkins, then adding silicate rock dust to the soil can improve protection against fungal diseases that pumpkins and those sort of squash type plants are very susceptible to. And one of the interesting features about using rock dust, as you probably already know, is that it's one of the few fertilizers you can use within organic agriculture. And that's one thing that we actually escaped in our paper, the realization that this could be promoted as an organic fertilizer for organic agriculture. And people are willing to pay a premium for organic agricultural products, so that might help with the economics of actually doing it.
What happens to ecosystems when the runoff from this added rock dust inevitably runs into the rivers?
Well, that's a good question. I think, you know, the honest answer is that's still under investigation. We know that as the minerals weather, they produce dissolved organic carbon and also a kind of very, very weak alkaline solution which drains into the rivers. Ultimately, that will drain into the surface oceans. And because it's weakly alkaline, it could help buffer ocean acidity caused by rising CO2. But what the direct consequences of that are on the biodiversity of river sediments and rivers themselves remains to be investigated.
So what's the end storage point for the carbon? Is it in the oceans? Is it in the soil? Where does it go?
Yeah, so there are two kind of main storage depots for the carbon. One would be the soil. It may precipitate out as carbonate in the first instance, and then in the longer instance, you might form a dissolved bicarbonate, which flushes out through surface runoff into rivers and then into the oceans. Where it's stored in the oceans, a dissolved organic carbon is on a time scale of about 100,000 to a million years. And we know that the storage capacity of the oceans is huge. They already store more than 40 times the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, so we could easily tuck away our fossil fuels into the surface oceans and have very little impact.
And what sort of rocks work best for enhanced weathering?
So in an ideal world, what you want are very fast-reacting rocks, but it turns out these are called ultramafic rocks. But it turns out that these ultramafic rocks also have, or quite often have, high concentrations of metals like chromium and nickel that are toxic to plants. So you certainly wouldn't want to put those on your croplands that you're going to then eat the yields from. So what we suggest in the paper is that a better candidate rock might be basalt, which is left over from ancient volcanic eruptions and which is extremely abundant. And based on very large compendium of analyses, we find no evidence that it's got heavy metal contamination in there that would pose a problem to the human food chain.
Now, we're going to have to mine massive amounts of this rock. What happens to the ecosystems where that rock is mined? I mean, is this open pit mining? There must be impacts there.
Oh, sure. So the amount of rock that you need at the global scale depends on the extent to which it's rolled out and the application rate, you know, per unit land area. And our recent calculations, which haven't been published yet, suggest you might need 6 or 7 billion tons of rock a year annually if you were to apply it to, say, 50% of the most productive managed croplands of the world. Now, that sounds like a huge number until you realize that we're already producing between 7 and 18 billion tons of silicate waste from industrial processes. And so conceivably, if that material was suitable and that would require more research, then you could think about how we develop a kind of circular economy where we're recycling this material without doing any extra mining and still capturing carbon.
That's like steel mill waste, for example.
Yeah, so steel mill waste and construction and demolition waste and also iron slag as well. So in the U.S., I think the U.S. had the earliest patent for putting processed slag onto weathered soils in Florida, which went back to about 1871, I think. And somewhere along the way, we kind of lost the will or the desire or the economics wasn't right, and now we don't do that so much anymore. Perhaps with the arrival of the Haber-Bosch process and NPK fertilizers, we've forgotten what silicate rocks can do to replenish soils.
I found it in old agricultural books, which was kind of interesting, along with wood ash, of course, which they had plenty of in the day. Now, your paper also investigates erosion rates and soil loss. Why?
Well, one of the problems with modern agricultural farming is that because you're tilling the soil so much, you're basically causing the soil to turn over, the organic matter oxidizes, and then the soil sort of essentially blow away in the wind. And so we have a very significant global soil erosion problem. Now, if we were to start adding silicate rocks back, this would start to help rebuild agricultural soils in several different ways. One way is that as those silicate rocks weather, they produce clays, and the clays themselves increase the water-holding content of the soil, and they can also attract organic molecules, which then form very tightly bound organic carbon coatings around the clay grains, and this increases the soil organic carbon concentration of the soils. And so these two different routes, the increase in water retention and increase in soil organic carbon, plus the fact that they can stimulate microbial growth and the growth of mycorrhizal fungi, can all help to start rebuilding soils and reverse this kind of global problem of soil erosion.
I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock from the University of Sheffield. My guest is Professor David Bierling. We're talking about carbon farming with rock dust to help reduce climate change. I found an earlier paper on this subject titled The Potential of Enhanced Weathering in the UK. It's by Philip Renforth, who was then at Oxford Geoengineering Program. I didn't know they had one, but they do. And he attempted to calculate the economic cost of large-scale enhanced weathering. Does your paper look into the cost, and if not, why not?
The paper doesn't deal with costs, and in fact, economic analysis of the of how much it might cost is something that our group is currently working on very intensively. Without giving too much away from our unpublished work, I would say that Phil's estimates are probably not too far away. One of the things that we're interested in doing a sort of global calculation for costs is figuring out, first of all, how much electricity is required to grind the rocks into a fine powder to increase their reactive surface area. And to do that, you need to know the different mix of energy sources by each nation and also the intensity of CO2 emitted by each of those energy sources. And then you also need to know the price of electricity for each nation. So it becomes quite an involved calculation. That's just the grinding side of it. If you're going to distribute your rocks, you need to know globally what the cost of diesel is and how many miles you're doing. So there's different layers of that calculation, and it was beyond the scope of the paper that we've just published, but it's something that we're working on for our next paper.
To be clear, what you propose is geoengineering, isn't it?
I would say, in a sense, I think the scientific community is moving more away from classifying approaches that remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere as geoengineering. The National Academy of Sciences in the US prefers to call these sorts of techniques, you know, climate intervention, because they feel that the word engineering implies a degree of precision and certainty that's unwarranted with these approaches. Other people might call it adaptation. You know, we're adapting how we grow our crops to capture carbon and reduce usage of agrochemicals would be another way to think about it. I hesitate to classify it as geoengineering.
All right. And your paper says almost 11% of the land on Earth is used for crop production. And that's a stunning area. I didn't know it was that large. I presume that's enough to capture the carbon we need?
Well, it's important to recognize that even if we could deploy it on 15 million kilometers squared of croplands, it wouldn't be economical, and B, you wouldn't want to do that anyway, because there are areas where it's highly productive and warm and very conducive to weathering. But I think, you know, the bigger issue is that in order to solve the climate change problem, we're going to need a portfolio of options for taking CO2 out of the atmosphere. And there's no one approach that's going to take all of it out to help us get to our climate targets that were discussed in Paris a couple of years ago. We really need a portfolio of options, and I would say at the moment it's too early to take any particular option off the table, and we should pursue research in all of these different areas.
Where would be the best places, David Bierling, to begin this program, perhaps to test it out on a large scale with the least carbon emissions given out?
Well, somewhere where they have, you know, somewhere, for example, like Brazil, where you have a warm climate, and that's coupled with a large land area where they use, which they use to grow a bioenergy crop, a sugar cane. And those crops are grown on heavily weathered soils that are typically acidic, and they require high inputs of expensive fertilizers that are very intense, require a lot of energy to produce. And they have a lot of co-located basalt reserves in that region. So, you know, from a sort of economic point of view, and also from a sort of practical standpoint, Brazil might be a very nice target country to begin to undertake these sorts of studies.
I noticed throughout the paper we find a list of big questions in a wide variety of sciences that need more research. You've mentioned a couple here in the interview. Given the pace of science and science funding, that could take a decade or two. Do we have that time?
Well, I think in order to persuade policymakers that this is something worth doing, then we need to establish the evidence base. And doing science takes time. And, you know, doing good science takes time. And, you know, the reality is that if we're going to limit future climate change, we need not only to curb our emissions, but also develop approaches for taking CO2 out of the atmosphere. Now, the lead-in time for some of these approaches may be longer than others, and there are low-hanging fruit that were identified by earlier work where, for example, you know, we should undergo aggressive programs of afforestation and reforestation in particular regions, which would at least begin to capture carbon and buy us time whilst the research in some of these other areas progresses.
In a press release from Columbia University, James Hansen endorsed this method of carbon capture, and I see he is also a co-author. What role did Hansen play in this research? Was he an advisor? Did he read through the paper?
Well, Jim was closely involved in it. He was one of the first people to recognize, you know, the importance of actually undertaking research on negative emissions technologies or carbon dioxide removal approaches. And Jim was very helpful in helping us frame some of the questions, particularly in relation to climate change and how it could contribute to climate change mitigation in a way that was robust and also, you know, posed questions for policymakers.
But I noticed that as a botanist, which you are, a well-known botanist, you also have the interest in feeding the world as the population grows and our croplands, as you've noted, may shrink due to rising seas. So there's that second driver for you beyond climate, isn't there?
That's right. I think the challenge of feeding, you know, 9 million people in 2050 is about trying to produce more food on existing land, managing our resources more efficiently, rather than chopping down more tropical forests. And, you know, if we can develop approaches that increase food production whilst at the same time making that more sustainable for the environment, then I think that's the way forward.
Given the need that we all recognize to save ourselves from an extreme climate shift, do you and your team think that enhanced weathering through soil supplements is the best chance we have?
Well, as I said earlier, I feel that we need a portfolio of options. And some of them are what you might call technology ready, the low-tech ones like afforestation and reforestation. Some of them are more controversial. And I feel that this particular approach is unique in that not only does it offer opportunities for improving food and soil security, but it might also offer approaches for mitigating against ocean acidification. Not many of the other approaches have that unique combination of selling points.
So where do we go from here? How do we develop this carbon capture technology?
So the next steps are really to, as we sort of discussed earlier, is to think a little bit in a lot more detail about the economics for this and actually what it would involve for each nation, what fraction of their GDP would be involved. We need to do a lot more work on figuring out how much carbon this system could capture. I think, you know, the economics and the amount of carbon the approach could capture are very important. And then I think, you know, the third point is thinking about field trials. You know, we really need to go out in the field and investigate how this operates in the real world. It's okay having models in model world, but really what we need to know is how does it work in reality? And that's one of the things that the Leverhulme Center is doing, is undertaking field trials, both in the U.S. with the University of Illinois with Champaign-Urbana, but also in Malaysia and also in Australia. So we can really connect, join the dots between doing experimental work and doing modeling work and actually seeing what happens in the field.
We are running out of time, and that's a shame because I really would love to dive into your book, The Emerald Planet, How Plants Changed Earth's History. I've been reading up how trees began, the first development of cellulose, and as you talked about, their march across the planet and changing the atmosphere. Perhaps we can talk about that another time.
For sure. I'd be delighted to discuss it.
Cool. I'll look forward to that. We've been speaking with Dr. David Bierling from the University of Sheffield in the UK. After groundbreaking research into the climate of deep time and 200 published papers, David is now the lead author of a broad new paper titled Farming with Crops and Rocks to Address Global Climate, Food, and Soil Security. That was published in Nature Plants in February 2018. You can find links to the science in my show blog at ecoshock.org. David, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Did you know that cities are actually much more polluting than we thought? And we find this out from the international environmental journalist Stephen Leahy. He's been a guest on Radio EcoShock before. It's been a while. Stephen, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Alex.
So you've got a new article in National Geographic, and it's about cities. Tell us what you're talking about.
Well, cities have a focus on trying to meet the climate challenges of the Paris Climate Agreement, and so they've been looking at their emissions. And a brand new study looked at how much emissions come from the products and services they consume and they obtain from outside their borders. So food, electronics, you know, all the kind of stuff we buy when we're in a city comes from other places, not usually made in the city. So what are all the emissions involved when you look at all the stuff that's imported into a city? That turns out to be pretty substantial. About 60% of a city's emissions come from outside the city. And that's a new number in the sense that cities have been working on trying to reduce their emissions, but they haven't been accounting for their consumption emissions. So this means that their emissions are actually 60% larger.
And you got this from a conference that you attended?
Yeah, it's the IPCC Cities Conference. It's the first time the scientists, the city planners, the urbanites, the members of civil society all to get together to talk about how cities can play a key role in the climate fight.
And I guess it's no surprise, but I read in your article that a city in India might be putting out the pollution, and we think from our viewpoint, well, gee, it's terrible, the pollution in India, but that is our pollution when we buy the products that were made in that city.
That's right. We're in the rich countries offshoring our pollution and our carbon emissions.
And I think the other key thought that I found from your article is something we all know, but we don't want to talk about, and that is that mass transit is good, putting in LEDs is good, any kind of energy saving is good, but it's not going to be enough. Really, we just have to stop shopping. We have to consume less.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's probably the first time I heard some leading public figures, like mayors, including the mayor of Edmonton, saying that Canadians need to consume less if we're going to meet the climate challenge. And for that matter, the climate scientists who are part of the IPCC are also saying the same thing. And in fact, going as far as saying that the current economic system that's based on growth and consumption has to be overturned.
And I mean, this is a striking blow in another sense, in that cities have been taking the leadership role. A lot of countries have fallen apart on their climate planning and not really delivered much, but cities really are trying to green up.
Yeah, they are. For instance, Oslo has got a target of 35% reduction in its emissions by 2020 from a 1990 baseline, which is way ahead of pretty well any other country. They're just about there because they've actually have, along with their finance budget, they have a climate budget where every year they ratchet down their emissions as part of their normal business. But they haven't yet addressed the consumption emissions. And when I talked to the city officials there, they said, yes, we are aware of the problem, and we know that, you know, Oslo and Norway generally has a very large consumption footprint, and they're going to address it in the coming years.
What else are you working on these days, Stephen?
I'm working on an article about water, which is related to the fact that we offshore our water as well. So when you're buying an orange in Toronto or New York, you're actually buying about 80 liters of water from some other country. And this is part of the problem that Cape Town is having. Everybody's hearing about their possibility of a major city running out of water in the near future. Well, one of the issues there is Cape Town is the center of the South African wine industry, and they export 400 million liters of wine. And that means they're exporting all the water it took to grow and process that wine. And South Africa is a very dry country, so this is a major use of their limited water resources for an export crop. So that's one of the reasons why Cape Town's running out of water.
Well, this is something you do have expertise in. Your 2014 book was Your Water Footprint, The Shocking Facts About How Much Water We Use to Make Everyday Products. And there we go. We can tie that right back into the cities. When we buy things, there's a lot of water involved.
Yeah, absolutely. Astonishing amounts of water. And that's something we're going to have to address. I mean, in other words, should countries that have quite dry climates be exporting enormous amounts of their water in the form of products?
There's a wild guy in New York, the Church of Stop Shopping, with Billy Talon. And right now, he seems like sort of a fringe guy. And I think in 10 years' time, or pretty soon now, he's going to become somebody we all want to hear about, because the Church of Stop Shopping is where it's at. If we're going to actually change the carbon footprint, and your report kind of shows this, your article shows this, that we've got to count all of the pollutions of everything we buy.
Yeah, absolutely, because it's a false economy if you're not counting at all. I mean, the physics of climate doesn't allow any fudges. But the other thing that was emphasized at the city's IPC conference was making these reductions in emissions and consumption isn't going to make our lives worse. It will make our lives a lot better. So, for instance, within cities, when they reduce the amount of, let's say, car traffic to get their emissions down from transportation, then the air quality improves, the walkability of cities improve, they generally become nicer places to live. And there's a very strong understanding that even by reducing our consumption, we will be happier and better off. It's going to take a time to make that transition, because we're sort of used to that we get our happiness from buying stuff, but in fact we get our happiness from doing things together.
Yeah, instead of shopping, maybe we could get together, have some sort of, you know, interplay and talk with one another. I could see that this could work out better. Some people have gone for voluntary simplicity already, and that's the way of the future if we want to keep a climate that isn't going to heat us out and storm us out and stress us out.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, simple things like Paris is actually encouraging the French to go vegetarian as part of their climate plan.
Wow, that's a brave move against the French farmers.
That's right.
So what's your website, Stephen? How can people follow what you're doing?
I'm at stephenleahy.net.
And that's Stephen with a P-H and L-E-A-H-Y. Thank you so much for talking with us today on Radio EcoShock.
You're more than welcome.
Radio EcoShock.
We're out of time for this week. Please join us again and support the More Radio EcoShock campaign at our website, ecoshock.org. Thank you so much for listening.